Welcome to First Reading, the Old Testament lectionary podcast for friends of the Hebrew Bible everywhere. I'm Dr. Rosie Candethal, newly minted from Emory Hebrew Bible, and currently a Louisville Institute postdoctoral fellow in Hebrew Bible at Columbia Theological Seminary.
And I'm Dr. Tim McBinch. I'm assistant professor of Hebrew Bible at Christian Theological Seminary, the other CTS.
Yes.
And the two of us are back after an Easter season of some of the best of First Reading episodes. We have something new and fresh for you, something we've never done before except once or twice or three times. We're here on Trinity Sunday with the first Sunday after Pentecost, Sunday, May 26th, 2024. And the first reading for the week is, drumroll, Isaiah 6, verses 1 to 8. We may also get to talk about Psalm 29 and maybe the New Testament readings as well. Knowing that I'm talking to Dr. Rosie here, it's likely we'll
get
the gospel reading in there somewhere.
That's right. I'm always trying to sneak that in for you preachers.
So here we are with Isaiah's encounter with a vision of the Holy One. And what do we want to talk about?
Well, maybe we'd give just a little bit of background like we usually do, right? So we're in 1st Isaiah, 8th century prophet. Isaiah and his community are facing the Assyrian threat on the threshold and just the sense of political empires aligning for and against this small community as they try to figure out what their future might be. What, Tim, would you like to maybe point us to? Is there more on the historical context that you want to kind of draw us toward as we think about what the prophet might be facing in this moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think you put it well. I mean, the political context here is just looming large, right? It's even set in that first verse of the chapter with the death of King Uzziah. And within that sort of is implied the whole background of this coming alliance between the northern kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Aram and their sort of political machinations against the empire of Assyria, which is also knocking on the door of Judah. And so all of that's happening, and it's looming large over everything that's happening in this little kingdom of Judah. And so here's this little prophetic voice trying to say something meaningful into a context that seems just so saturated with the external political pressure, right? To me, that informs the kind of way that Isaiah presents this vision of the Holy One as not just sort of like, well, if you want something spiritual or religious to think about in your spare time, here's something else to think about. It's no, this is the dominant thing you should be thinking about, this dominant, impressive image of the Holy One who is large and in charge and makes the empire look small.
Right. Yeah, right. So again, pointing to that, the death of King Uzziah, a period of, you know, possible instability, regime changes are always times when people feel vulnerable, especially those who are on the margins. And this is just true across time, right? So setting that in the background and this transcendent, as you've said, Tim, just kind of an image of God still on this throne, despite what it looks like all around you. And that is kind of what we're opening this vision with. And it might be just something that we also kind of think about in our contemporary circumstances where there is a lot of political instability and looking forward and thinking about what's going to happen in November, you know, to this country, what's happening across the world in Israel and Palestine and in various areas of unrest. So not so completely different from our own times and as we think about this prophetic vision.
Yeah, I mean, I step into our present moment just feeling a sense of powerlessness and smallness and trying to figure out how to find my voice. Like, what can I say here that would be helpful? Is there anything that I can say or do that would make any lick of difference in this context, which is so dominated by these huge, huge problems and powers? And I feel like, yeah, Isaiah probably had some of that same feeling of this, all this stuff happening on this big stage. And I'm just little me. What do I have to contribute here? And then has this experience, this encounter.
Yeah. So let's get into it. What does Isaiah see?
Isaiah sees God. which in itself is a pretty amazing thing to report, right?
Right. I saw the Lord, right? Like,
Yeah.
okay. Saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lofty. And the hem of his robe filled the temple, right? So many of our preachers and teachers are probably recall that image. The hem of his robe is filling the temple.
Right. So like the I sort of think about that. I don't know if this is meant to imply the temple in Jerusalem or just like a vision of a temple or a heavenly temple, but whatever space this is meant to convey, like just the edge, the bottom edge of God's robe fills up the space. Like
Right.
just the little corner. I mean, that's all the space that we have in the temple is for this little corner of God's robe. That gives you a sense of the scale of the vision, right?
The majesty of God is the God's presence, that kavod, that glory, that just as you said, just the hem of his garment fills the entire temple. And then beyond that, right, we get the mysterious seraphs, right? So if we're just going to build this picture, we have the hem of God's robe filling the temple, and then seraphs are in attendance above him. And we've had conversation about what are these seraphim, fiery serpents is the way that we might literally translate this. So not a maybe a friendly image, but just something of great power and mystery. Beasts, Tim, you and I have talked about an image of a monster, even like something that is not familiar. With two wings, they are covering their faces, with two, they cover their feet, and with two, they fly. So, not like any serpent that you've ever encountered. And they are speaking to one another.
With that reverberating, holy, holy, holy. And in one of our past conversations, we talked to Dr. Ethan Schwartz. Actually, it was you and I, Rosie,
Yes.
who had that conversation with Ethan. And he proposed this theory, which it still intrigues me, of this threefold holy declaration being kind of the way in literature to describe an echo, so that the declaration of God's holiness, just like God's kavod is filling up everything, so in an auditory way, the proclamation of God's holiness is filling the space. And it's all you can hear is just God's holiness. Holy, 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 holy.
That's amazing. Right. Yeah. I think it's worth repainting this picture of just how mind-blowing and on every sense, right? So eyes are open, ears are hearing. There's the wonder of the beating wings of these serpents. Like there's just this is a full of strangeness and full of majesty in the midst of all of what we just described of political difficulties, conflicts, and confusion. Here's this very clarifying image of a power that is difficult to fully comprehend, imagine, describe, right? Yeah.
And describe is a good word because it's worth remembering that we as readers of this are hearing the prophet describe this experience. So it's not like we're actually there with him. We're hearing a report of this, and it hearing it as conveyed as a report makes me ask the question, why is Isaiah telling us this? What does Isaiah want us to get from this description of the majesty of God? What do you think, Rosie?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's painting this picture of the political conflicts and confusion that was surrounding this moment with the death of one king, and the impending threat of empires surrounding this small nation. There is the reaffirmation of the God whom Isaiah and this people worship and have centered in their lives, right? That Yahweh has not disappeared. Yahweh is firmly on this throne, and holy, 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 set apart, set apart, set apart. Just the reverberations, as you've reminded us, of what that might mean in this moment. That what you might see in ahead of you is not what is actually real. And so that is what I think Isaiah is trying to clarify. What is really real here is this image of God.
I think that's really salient because, I mean, in Isaiah's time, the pressure was to find a way to, work the political machine in order to ensure the survival of your kingdom. So you're making alliances with this kingdom or that, or figuring out how to serve as a vassal to the empire and pay tribute and all of this, and sort of figure out what can we do to ensure our survival politically. And Isaiah, from what we can tell, was pretty much against all of that, right? He was firmly in favor of asserting little Judah's independence and of relying for protection not on political alliance with some other kingdom's military, but by just trusting in the power of God to sustain the people. And so here's this vision of a God who is fully capable of laying waste to one's enemies, of defending God's own turf. And I feel like that's sort of the big impact of this large and in charge deity.
And then right, here's Isaiah's response to this. It's not what we, just a joyful welcoming of
Let's
this.
sing a praise song.
Yeah, that's not right. I mean, so the first words out of his mouth is, "Alas, woe is me. Oh, I am lost. I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and yet my eyes have seen the King, Yahweh, King of hosts, so Lord Sabaoth, right? So of armies. So, I mean, do you want to say something about this?
I mean, it does strike me that the response here is not one of, oh, this is great. Now I can relax and be happy. And the image of the power of this deity is frightening because it's not taken for granted that this power will be directed on your behalf, right? So having encountered this power, Isaiah's response is, oh no. Right? So that declaration of woe, oily, is really potent. I was really struck as I was reading it this time by the follow-up there. I'm a person of unclean lips, and I dwell among a people of unclean lips. And that's not a phrase that I tend to use in my day-to-day life. So I got thinking about unclean lips and what that might mean. For me, the focus on lips has to do with speech, which I think is relevant for Isaiah as a prophet, as a potential spokesperson for the divine. And if this is like a prophetic calling report or narrative, then Isaiah's own sort of like authority to speak on behalf of this deity, that's what's in question here, right? So he recognizes from the outset that he actually doesn't carry the worthiness to speak, to use his lips on behalf of this Holy One, because his lips are worthless. They're unclean. They're not worth this kind of vocation. They don't carry the kind of what we might call moral authority or prophetic authority to speak in this political realm on behalf of the deity. That's the presenting problem, right? I don't have the authority to say anything meaningful on behalf of that powerful deity that I've just witnessed.
Right, and I also hear the assertion of the incredible gap between us and God, right? I mean, that w woe is me, like just a recognition all of a sudden of like, I'm human, I am human, and you are God, and I can't live, having seen that. Like, there's something that I have caught about my condition that makes, my proximity to you impossible, and yet the prophet speaks of a proximity that's incredibly difficult to describe, right? And in that moment is filled with terror about what that means existentially for himself and for his people. Like, as you've kind of pulled out, he's not alone. He recognizes that the impact of this vision is not a personal one. It matters to his community. I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean of unclean lips. And how then should we go forward? How could we speak of what we've seen and what we know? And now there's, as you said, the story continues to unfold. It's not as though God leaves him in this agony. A seraph then immediately flies, ministers to him, holding a live coal that's been taken from the altar with a pair of tongs, and addresses the ritual uncleanness that that Tim has kind of pointed out. This is not this is a recognition that maybe something can be done.
Yeah, and it's significant, I think, that this is the seraph is acting on behalf of God, on behalf of the Holy One. It's God who's crossing that gap, right? Taking the initiative to address the impropriety of Isaiah's lips, right? So it's not like woe is me, I'm a man of unclean lips, and now I'm going to fix that. No, it's I have no recourse here, but the Holy One sends agency to repair the situation and make possible the use of Isaiah's lips for divine purposes.
I think in this conversation too, I'm just recognizing how there is this ritual moment here where it is said, now that this has touched your lips, your guilt has departed, your sin is blotted out. So in that moment, there is a ritual cleanliness that is then kind of offered to Isaiah to allow the next part of this call to proceed. But there's an exchange, as you've said, right? So it's God has sent an emissary, sent a pastor in the seraph, in this beast, in this monster that approaches physically to touch Isaiah's lips and to give him, I don't know, comfort through a coal, comfort through this fire, somehow to offer him a purification that will allow him to respond when God's voice finally thunders. I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send? Who will go for us?" And Isaiah, in this audacious response, says, "Here am I, send me." Which everyone remembers, but also just, I mean, if we can draw out how audacious this response is in light of what Isaya has caught a glimpse of.
You know, I just have to remark, though, something you just said, I helped me to think about this. Something I'd never seen before, actually. Up until this point, Isaiah has not heard the voice of God.
That's the thing that I've, yes.
It's not until that ritual moment, that healing, that cleansing happens. It's all fuzz, and all he can hear is the declaration of God's holiness. But then when this seraph flies and sizzles his lips with the coal, it's like the dial on the radio tunes in, and all of a sudden, clearly, he can hear the voice of God for the first time.
That's what struck me in my reading this too, is all of a sudden the voice of the Lord only comes all the way out in verse 8. That's the voice of the Lord. All along, it's all of the voices of the heavens, like as you said, the echo. And it's only after his lips have been silenced in some way, or Isaiah recognizes his own inability to speak, that now God speaks.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I feel like I want to preach a little bit about that.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I would love if that's an angle for preachers. And I think Tim and I, in our conversations, we were prepping for this episode. The thing that I kept hearing among all the passages was the voice of God, right? So Psalm 29, if you're looking at the four readings for this Trinity Sunday, the voice of God thunders, right? And it's a voice that maybe has some things in common with this passage. It is a voice that makes the world tremble. It makes trees shake. It makes the mountains tremble, right? So just that the tremendous wonder of this transcendent God and the ability of God's voice to fill the whole earth, that is overall. And yet the psalmist is in conversation with this voice in Romans 8, right, which is the other kind of epistle that we're reading. Romans 8, it's the voice of the Spirit of God that tells us that we're children adopted by God. So we have something in common with God's self and also the rest of the children of God. So there's a recognition that we're part of a community. And then in John 3, which is our gospel passage, right? Obviously, it's Nicodemus who's coming at night to come and hear the voice of God in Jesus. So if that's of any help to preachers as they're thinking about Isaiah 6 in relationship to some of these others these other passages that are offered for this Trinity Sunday, the voice of God would be a wonderful one to zero in on and to maybe really think about the quality of God's voice in all of these passages.
Absolutely. And I feel like, in addition to God's voice, God's initiative here is really significant to me. And maybe it's just my Presbyterianism coming through, like the whole divine sovereignty, divine initiative, human inability. But that theme seems to pop up here as well, that this act of retuning Isaiah's faculties to be able to perceive even the voice of God at all takes divine initiative to happen. And coming back to the gospel passage in John 3, it's the work of the Spirit which blows where it will that enables people to have this renewal, this new birth, to even perceive the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God. So I think that's a there's a theme there of God's initiative in equipping people for participation in the work of God in the world.
I love that because the voice of God asks two questions, right? Who shall I send? Who will go for us, right? So in the kind of highlighting of both God's initiative, but also God asks a question, which is begging for a response, right? So Isaiah is the one who recognizes that there's an invitation that God is giving in God's voice, surrounded by all these affirmations of God's holiness. God gives place to Isaiah, this mortal man whose lips are unclean, acknowledged, who lives among a people of unclean lips, acknowledged, and yet God has work for you. So there's hope in that, right?
I feel that hope. I mean, I feel the sense of the unclean lips thing in my own life, in my own context. I just even, living as somebody who identifies with the Christian faith in this world in which Christians have done so much harm through the ages, and what sort of weight do my words carry when it comes to something like peace? When I'm a warmonger and I dwell among a warmongering people, how do I say something about peace? Or what might I say about freedom of speech in these days when I'm a censor and I dwell among a speech squashing people? Right? Or equity when I'm full of embedded racism and implicit bias and I dwell among a people who are saturated with white supremacy. Like, I don't have something in me that equips me or enables me to speak with any kind of prophetic or moral authority, right? And I feel like this passage, this Isaiah 6 passage, acknowledges that, like you say, it doesn't deny that loss of the prophet's moral authority, but it shifts the source of the authority from Isaiah, from the prophet, to the deity. Your lips are clean not because you've done anything to make them clean. Your lips are clean because I now make them clean and I designate them for this calling, this purpose that I'm giving them. And that does give me hope. It makes me think that if God gives us something to say, it carries moral weight or moral authority, not because of who we are, but because it comes from God. And therefore it has the authority of the voice of God, that voice like in the psalm, which accomplishes so much and represents so much.
That's beautiful. I think, I mean, I imagine many preachers and teachers also struggle with the same thing, like the idea of, do I have anything new? Do I have anything to offer? Do I have anything with weight to offer my people? And Isaiah, as eager as Isaiah is, he's not prepared for the message that God will give Isaiah to speak. And so our reading cuts off at that moment of consolation, right? So let's just acknowledge that our reading stops at "Here am I, send me." W wonderful, right? But it leaves off verses 9 through 13, where the message becomes very difficult for Isaiah. So the message basically God says is, "Go and say to this people, keep listening but do not comprehend, keep looking but do not understand." So it's a message that obfuscates. It's a message that does not bring clarity or necessarily peace or consolation to the people that Isaiah will minister to. And Isaiah's response is an agony, right? So how long,
How long
Lord?
do I have to do this?
How long do I have to
What
do that?
did I just sign up for?
Right. I imagine for many preachers and teachers, this might hit home, right? I mean, there are times we need to say things that we don't want to, grades that I have to offer that I don't want to. How long, Lord? Do we speak these messages that are not always clarifying, right? And God's response: until cities lie waste without inhabitant, houses without people, the land is utterly desolate. I mean, this is not a consoling message that Isaiah is being sent out with. And I think it's a valuable reminder to say that our passage cuts off at a place that doesn't allow for that message to get through. And I want to reaffirm the fact that the voice of the Lord is not always consoling. It is not always clarifying that even as we kind of put this into conversation with the Gospel of John 3, Nicodemus is not left understanding what Jesus says. He's like, what do you mean? How can someone be born again if they've been born once? Like, what do you mean, born of water and spirit? I mean, Nicodemus is confounded, and Jesus does not offer him clarity. He says, do you not understand this? You're a religious teacher, you're an expert. And I can hear Jesus saying things like that to me. Do you not yet understand that the voice of God is not something to be handled with your unclean hands that way? That the message is one that God gives, and that I humbly maybe accept and struggle through and recognize that there's a work that's being done in me as well, in the voice of God and how I respond.
And it goes to show that even when a message is true, that doesn't necessarily mean that it will be received, right? Or
Right.
even understood.
Yeah, and that's okay, right? I mean, that's what these passages seem to affirm. And as we think about also this liturgical moment, right? We've been calling it Trinity Sunday, but we might draw our attention as well that the Sunday right before is Pentecost, and the voice of God in that moment speaks in many different languages to all diversity of peoples, but speaking to them in a personal way about God's works. But as we remember that moment, it's very early in Acts, and there's a lot that is unsettled about this community. There is a lot about this church that we don't see yet, and there's a lot of persecution that's about to come in Acts. So, in that sense, like there's a consistency. The voice of God speaks with some clarity, offers some consolation, but not always a clear way forward. And that's worth reiterating. The Trinity as a doctrine lends some clarity to the relationship between the three persons of God, but does not resolve the essential mystery that sits at the heart of Trinity. So, I mean, if there's anything to just also take in the liturgical moment, is just maybe a recognition of our inability to grasp this mystery.
And I think that's important, especially with the perhaps the temptation when encountering these lectionary texts on Trinity Sunday to look to like holy, holy, holy and say, oh, three holies? Oh, there's the Trinity. Or, even in the gospel, this Jesus is talking to Nicodemus about the spirit. And so we have two out of three, not bad. Oh, and then the God so loved the world,
Yep, the
sent the
Father.
Son. So it would be tempting to take these passages and say, ah, there it is, Trinity, end of story. But none of these texts are intended in the first place to serve as like proof texts for some doctrine of the threeness of God. And so that would be maybe a preaching pitfall. Don't stop at trying to prove something about the Trinity. Embrace the Trinity as a mystery and take these texts into their depth to what's happening there. My thought about how this might angle into Trinity Sunday is that this work of God to bring renewal of lips or new birth, a birth from above, is kind of an all hands on deck work of the triune God. So we see, the persons of the Trinity engaged in this. It's not just like the work of redemption, of renewal, isn't just the work of the Son of God, the second person of the Trinity, right? We see that it's the blowing of the spirit that leads to new birth. And we see the work of the Holy One, cleansing the lips of the prophet. So in the mystery of the triunity of the Godhead is this sense that the wholeness of God is involved in this work of giving newness, new birth, redemption, in order to equip a people for participation in the renewal of the world.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, I mean, I'm struck by how that also kind of fits in with where I was kind of seeing these passages with the voice of God that always invites response, right? So I mean, the questions that are being invited through the voice of God and, you know, whom shall I send? Who will go for us? And then it's Isaiah's response, here am I, and then how long, O Lord, right? There's a back and forth. The voice of God doesn't end debate. It's an authority to continue a dialogue with God and with one another that I find really nourishing in these passages. The Trinity is not the end of a conversation. It's the beginning, in some sense, a God that shares dialogue with itself, which is also kind of like mind-boggling. The God self is in dialogue always. And what is that intimacy of conversation between the Godhead that then invites us into conversation and maybe a new way of being with each other and being in this world? If we truly recognize that we are adopted, we are heirs with Christ, that is what Paul is saying in Romans chapter 8. How do we draw that in? Joint heir, that's a legal term. You own property, you own this world with Jesus. That's crazy. When you look at what we've done with this world, what we have unclean lips and hands have done, you know, to me, I feel like I'm walking with Isaiah in my confession and also in my, you know, audacious hope that I too could be sent.
I'm really glad that you've brought into the conversation the idea of response, like that this is an invitation that calls for a response. I sometimes have thought about this as, especially thinking about John 3 and the sort of new birth, being born again, is this sort of thing that happens to you, and it's maybe considered like a one-off thing at some point in your past that it's great, and it sort of gives you a spot in the
Among the
people,
chosen,
yeah, among the chosen, right. But I think a careful look at these texts reveals that this new birth, both Isaiah's version of the renewal of his lips and this new vocation, and the John 3 version of new birth, it's something that happens to us, but it's not for us, right?
Wow.
Isaiah's renewal cleanses his lips so that he can speak to the people of God. Nicodemus's new birth wasn't for his own self, not only just for his own salvation, but so that he might see or might be able to perceive the kingdom of God, God's transformation of the world in partnership with a people. One way I thought about it was that new birth was not because God so loved Nicodemus, even though that was true, God did love Nicodemus, but because God so loved the world and was inviting Nicodemus to perceive and participate in that love for the world through an act of being born again in order to perceive and be a part of it. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right that these texts call for a response of participation in what God is doing.
Yeah, that's a wonderful place, I think, but perhaps to maybe leave it. We've offered some preaching angles and some pitfalls here, but hopefully the recognition is that Trinity Sunday is the beginning of a dialogue, hopefully, you know, or a renewed dialogue at least, in recognition that God's voice demands a response, and that all of us together are lending our part to that, making our faculties and our abilities and our gifts available to the work of God anew in this, you know, post-Easter season. We're living into it, into the wonder of Pentecost, into the wonder of the doctrine of the Trinity.
I think that's a great spot to cut it off for today. It's so good to get to chat with you, Dr. Rosie.
Hey.
We are actually recording this the day a couple days before Rosie and I both walk through our commencement ceremony as a newly minted PhDs. So we're kind of reveling in the moment of transition for us as well.
Yeah, and it's a joyful thing to get to share this walk with you, Tim. So I'm grateful that we get to share that special moment after many years of labor.
That's right. That's right. Well, thank you all for listening to our podcast this week. First Reading is produced by Rosie and myself, along with Dr. Rachel Wren and our good friend Paul Essa. You can find all of our back episodes on the website, firstreadingpodcast.com, where you can also find a whole bunch of interesting merchandise.
Yay.
I've been wearing this shirt that says Nefesh on it. And it's awesome. I love it. I might get myself a second one in a different color.
There you go.
That's a lot of fun. You are welcome out there if you would like to support the work that we're doing with a donation to First Reading. You can do that on our website, either a one-off or set something up on the regular. We appreciate all of that support that helps us keep this going. Until next time, I'm Tim McNinch.
And I'm Rosie Candlethal. Thanks for listening and happy preaching.